I'm Ken MacLeod. From the day we launched unfetteredmind.org, it has operated without a paywall, advertising, or a subscription charge. This is only possible through the generosity of people like you. If you find our materials useful, please make a donation at unfetteredmind.org/donate. Thank you, and enjoy this podcast.
Unfettered Mind, Power and Presence, Part 10.
Thank you. This is October 11th, our last teaching session. We have two things to do today. We're here. One is to cover 4 hours of material in half an hour. And the other is to conclude the story. The last point is receive the result. You have the four: show up, open to what is, serve what is true to the limit of perception, receive the result. Receive the result just means exactly what it says. You act, and whatever the outcome, you work with that. The opposite is when you act and the outcome isn't what you want, you try to make the outcome into something else. So, I had nothing to do with that. Or, circumstances were beyond my control. It's not so bad. You try to control things rather than just receive. Now, these four steps are not one-shot affairs. You show up, you open to what is, you serve what is true, you receive the result, and now there's another situation in which you show up, open to what is, serve what is true, receive the result. And now there's another situation in which you show up, open to what is true, open to what is, serve what is true, receive the result. So this is a way of living. When it comes to the acceleration that we've talked about, the situation or the new situations present themselves extremely quickly. Or it can. So that's part of what we were referring to right at the beginning of this retreat, when you were talking about staying in touch with what's happening, with the feedback that's arising, that's showing up in the new situation. And what enables you to receive that feedback is precisely receiving the result. So since Alex has been generous in talking about his last job, no, I'm not going to go there, you know. Don't worry about that. There was a whole process of new situations happening, one after the other. And that's the kind of thing that happens. What happens is we get fixed in a certain line of activity, and it prevents us from receiving the results. So we literally don't know what is happening. And then we get taken by surprise. This happens time and time again when couples split up. When couples split up, almost always there is an active person, the person who actually does the breaking up, and there's the other person. And for the other person, it always comes as a bolt out of the blue, because they haven't been in tune with the situation. So this ability to receive the result is very important. And to recognize that there's a new situation. It requires constant reappraisal of what you're doing and how you're doing it and what's happening in rapidly moving situations. It really is moment by moment. Now, most people want to know something about power, because they don't know how to handle conflict. So I want to talk a bit about conflict. First bit, what is conflict? Conflict is the experience of resistance to change when two or more worlds interact. Conflict is the experience of resistance to change when two or more worlds interact. So you have A and his world, B and his or her world, circumstances bring about some kind of interaction between A and B. It may be proximity, it may be geography, there may be other reasons, but there's some kind of interaction. As soon as there's any kind of interaction, a third world, we'll call it C, is formed. And the question is, what is C going to look like? Well, from A's point of view, C is going to look like A, or A's idea of C. From B's point of view, C is going to look like B's world, or B's idea of what C should be. But in fact, in almost all situations, C doesn't look like either A or B, or either of their ideas, But that may or may not be acceptable to A or B. And if they resist, conflict arises. It's the experience of resistance to change when two or more worlds interact. Conflict only arises in the context of relationship. If there's no relationship, there is no conflict. In extreme cases, such as some of the struggles in the Middle East, they say we don't have a relationship. Well, you do have a relationship. You live next to each other. And you may want each other dead. You still have a relationship. That third world is there. And both of you are resisting any change into that third world like crazy. So there's very intense. No relationship, no conflict. So what conflict represents is a problem in a relationship. And you never have any idea of how the conflict is going to evolve. You have a lot of experience. You can make some fairly good guesses, but you can never actually know. There are always too many factors in operation. Some of them can be just the operation of chance. Which means that when you enter a conflict, you cannot know the result. I'll come back and say a bit more about that in a moment. One of the more useful frameworks, which comes from the Tibetan tradition of protector practice, are the four stages of conflict: pacification, enrichment, magnetization, and destruction. Pacification, you seek to resolve the problem in the relationship, utilizing the resources that are at hand. This takes usually one of two forms. You talk things out, or you rearrange the furniture, figuratively or literally. There are many configurations of space which actually create conflict by virtue of the configuration. You change the configuration. You remove the conflict. One example is if you have a bunch of office equipment at one end and a narrow passage between, say, two desks to it and a number of people working. So they have to go through this narrow passage to get to the office equipment. Well, as soon as you do that, you set up a pecking order in the office. Who gives way to whom? Lots of conflict. If you widen the passage so that two or three people can pass in either direction at one time, the pecking order disappears, the basis of conflict disappears, and all you've done is rearrange the furniture. Enrichment. You seek to resolve the conflict by bringing in additional resources. One of the most common is money. Hollywood, working on a script, writer's not working out. Writer doesn't want to let go of his credit for the script. Executive calls him into his office, says, "I'll give you $250,000 to go away. Make it 300,000. Done. That's enrichment. Bribes, form of enrichment. Training, education. An apology. That is an expression of feeling that is greater than what would normally take place in such a setting. Facilitation, mediation. These are all methods of enrichment. If you're able to resolve the conflict at the level of pacification, the relationship strengthens because the two parties learn from the experience that they can work things out on their own. So they have a stronger relationship as a result. If they instead they go straight to enrichment, it's an expression of distrust in each other and the relationship. So it weakens the relationship. So it's very important to go to pacification first. If you're able to resolve it at the level of enrichment, after having gone through pacification, then sometimes it will strengthen the relationship. Sometimes it will weaken it. Depends on a lot of factors. If you aren't able to resolve the issue at the level of enrichment, you move to magnetization. Magnetization is where you use your personal power to compel a resolution. In very crude terms, you hold a gun to the person's head. You make them an offer they can't refuse. If you go back to The Godfather, for instance. My preferred method of using magnetization is to be a spokesperson for the situation. So you use the power in the situation, the energy of the situation, to compel a resolution. And I'm going to. About almost 20 years ago, there was one of the high lamas of the Kagyu school was visiting LA, and we knew about this well in advance. And at that time, there were three different centers in Kagyu tradition in LA. And the visit was going to be over the Thanksgiving weekend, with several days before Thanksgiving, the Thanksgiving weekend, and the some days following. No, actually, I think that's right. It doesn't matter. So when I was asked which days did I want, I took Thanksgiving weekend, because I knew neither of the other centers would want it. So there wasn't any argument. And I planned to do a retreat up here at Mount Baldy. And they were only too happy, because they all wanted to be, travel, etc. And they were happy not to be stuck with that weekend for their centers. That was cool. Fast forward 6 months. I've got all the plans set up for the retreat here. Full enrollment. People are coming in from all over the country. We actually had 55 people here that weekend. 2 weeks before this, I get a phone call. We think you're being very selfish doing this retreat. You're denying hundreds of people in Los Angeles the opportunity to meet this wonderful teacher. So we think you should reschedule. Oh, well, that's nice. Thank you for calling. Next day I got another phone call. Same message. I said, this doesn't make any sense. Why are you calling me now? This has been set for several months. This was decided a long time ago. And so, then I started getting a lot of phone calls. The conflict had escalated. I was hearing from people that I hadn't heard from 3-4 years, asking why I was being so selfish. So I said to this person, well, what do you want? Well, we think you should have the retreat in the city. I said, well, there isn't any location. Said, well, if I find a location, do it. I said, I'll consider it. A few days later, I found this location. Well, it wasn't suitable for any number of reasons, but I was tired of getting all of these phone calls. So I met with a couple of advisors and some of my students. I said, this is what's going on. What do you think? One of my students just looked at me and said, if you hold the retreat anywhere other than Mount Baldy, I'm not coming, and I don't think a lot of other people will either, because that's not what we want, and it's not what you do anyway, Kim. I went, oh. Then one of my advisors said to me, I think she just gave you the key you were looking for, Ken. And I went, right. So the next day, I called up this woman who had been putting all of this pressure and had orchestrated this phone campaign against me and said, here's the situation I'm in. Thank you for doing all of the research and finding this other location. I brought it up with my students. They rejected it completely. So I can't do anything here. However, you control this person's schedule. So if you feel this is really important, you cancel my retreat and you set up your own. But my hands are tied. My students have said this is the only retreat they want to do. I can't do anything else. It's all in your hands. Well, she didn't want to take that responsibility. So the retreat went forward. Is that clear enough for you, Carolyn? We had 55 people here. It was a bit strange, but it was a very good retreat. Used the power of the situation to compel a resolution. That doesn't always work. Sometimes you actually end up in trial, in court. Sometimes you end up at war. This is destruction. Destruction is destroying the aspect of the relationship in which the conflict arises. Parents do this all the time with children. Two children are fighting over a toy. What do the parents do? They take the toy away. That's destruction. What do the kids do then? Well, they usually look at each other and say, what do you want to do now? Destroyed the basis of the conflict. Sometimes destruction involves you leaving the situation. You quit. Or you quit that aspect of the relationship. I've had to do that a number of times. One of the ways it crops up is that a friend will ask me for some advice about something. I'll have to say, we're friends. You start asking my advice, that could change. So they think about that quite carefully. I think about it quite carefully because it changes everything. So keep those straight. Usually we don't do that because the being a consultant or providing advice is a very different relationship from being a friend. And it's important to respect that. Whenever you have dual relationships, you get into this bit. Henry Ford once said, "It's very sad when your friend becomes your business partner. It's very wonderful when your business partner becomes your friend." Because business partner and friend are very different relationships. Business partner is about making money together. Friendship's about emotional connection. Friendship's a much deeper form of relationship. So it's very sad when your friendship becomes a business relationship, and vice versa. When you enter conflict, you do not determine to which of those levels the conflict goes. You stay present in the conflict with your intention. The other person, the other party, determines which it goes. My martial arts teacher put it this way: why would I kill you if I could just maim you? Why would I maim you if I could just injure you? Why would I injure you if I could just embarrass you? Why would I embarrass you if I could just walk away? But if you don't let me walk away, then I will embarrass you. And if you don't stop when I embarrass you, then I will injure you, etc. This is something to keep in mind. Because in the course of engaging a conflict, if it moves to the level of destruction, something is going to die. You're going to meet death. It may not be clear what that is when you go in, but at some point, something is going to die. And if you aren't prepared for something to die, then maybe not such a good idea to engage the conflict. And so we've had various examples of that offered this afternoon, where take on a task at work which may put you in a bad position, could end up becoming a scapegoat, raises the possibility that you'll be fired. That's death in the business world. You criticize your wife's soup, find you're in divorce court. That's death in the marriage world. It's never about the soup. Sophie, Michelle.
Does internal conflict go through the same four stages?
Very good question, Sophie. Thank you. Exactly. How many of you have found certain of your expectations have had to die in the practice of your meditation practice, in the course of your meditation practice? How many of you have had to let go of certain ideals or certain character traits that you once took such great pride in?
Same stages of trying to magnetize?
Do you go through the same stages of trying to pacify and magnetize and then...
Oh, I think so. I mean, I'm going to sit until I reach awakening. I'm going to be just like Buddha. Can live with this. Maybe if I just put some support there, it'll feel better. No, I'm going to power through this. Maybe I better get some instruction after all. All four stages.
Well, where's this destroying though? Magnetizing would be.
I can see where you try to enrich it by getting yourself more comfortable in meditation, but I'm missing the other stages.
Magnetization. I'm going to power through this.
And then how do you destroy it?
I'm going to have to get some instruction after all. I'm not going to be able to be just like Buddha. Not give up, but give up being like Buddha. I'm going to have to get some instruction. I'm just going to have to be an ordinary human being after all. That's such a drag. My relationship with that ideal. Destroy it. Follow? Okay, Michelle.
One of the things I admire about dogs is that an emotionally healthy dog will never use more force than necessary.
Exactly.
So one of mine came to me because he was aggressive towards a child in his household. But what had actually happened was the dog weighs 120 pounds. The child weighed maybe a third of that. He was taking a nap one day, and she wanted to play, and she was in his face. And he got up, and he moved, and she followed him, and this happened several times. And eventually, he gave a little growl. And that caused her to move in, and she tried to ride him and, you know, tried to do any number of other things. And so he gave a larger growl, and she ignored it. And after some period of time, he snapped at her. And I know this because the mother told me the story.
Yeah.
She was in the room the entire time, and she decided the dog was vicious.
Her child could do no wrong. Steve?
I noticed that you put apology in the second category. I'm wondering why that isn't in the first category.
Depends on the circumstances. In some cases, it would be in the first category, but often in more formal settings, an apology or opening up that whole emotional realm is not the protocol. So then it would represent a level of enrichment.
So pacification is...
resources that are at hand. Enrichment would be, in the case of emotional stuff, putting a higher level of feeling or a deeper level of feeling into it. And you see this where people are having, they're in some kind of contention or other things, and one person says, you know, I never really meant to hurt you, I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. And the conflict's gone. Okay, now I've gone over my time, so I need to turn it over to Jeff at this point.
You got 4 days or 4 hours in 40 minutes? That was pretty good. Let's return to our story.
We keep changing the order.
Remember, it's a fairy tale. Okay? It's happening on It's in another realm. It started out in a time far beyond this one. It's not this time. So we last saw our prince stripped of his clothing, stripped of the sword of brightness, stripped of the fruit of happiness, and stripped of the white bird, left by the side of the road. The two brothers had returned to the king with what they'd taken from the younger brother, and immediately began crowing about what they'd brought. And the king said, "Well, where's the prince?" And, "Oh, God, he just went over to that tavern, you know. It's a day's walk down the road and spent the whole time drinking." So the king said, "Well, gosh, can you draw that sword? I want to see the sword." Well, the brothers, they couldn't get it out. Wouldn't budge. "Well, can I have a bite of that fruit of happiness? I'd really like to taste that fruit." And he took a bite, and it was bitter. And the white bird just cried and cried and cried. Well, the young prince, he stayed by the road for a bit, and then he decided, "I'm not going to just give this up." And he walked back to the castle, but they wouldn't let him in. Nobody recognized him. He was just some guy dressed in rags. And so he sat down by the gate. It was actually the gate that went out to a garden. And he sat there for a long time, and eventually the people in the court came out to take a stroll in the garden. And they all passed him by. Nobody recognized him. And a bit later, the king came out, walking with the white bird. The king passed him by too. He didn't recognize him. But the white bird saw him and immediately knew who he was and ran to him and kissed him and said, "This is my prince. This is the prince." So the prince stood up and explained to the king what had happened, that the whole adventure and how it had come about. And the king said, "Yes, yes, 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 but that's what your brother said. How do I know that you're telling the truth? Can you pull that sword out?" And he said, "Sure." And he took a hold of the scabbard and pulled the sword out, flashed in the light, shining brightly. And the king realized what had actually happened the whole time. And he was intent on punishing the two brothers, but they had already run out the back door when they heard that the prince had returned. But the prince was back. Now, why is this story called The White Bird? Any Tom, Jake, or Harry can find the fruit of happiness or find the sword of brightness. But it takes a real prince to find the white bird. That's the end of the story. So what does that last line mean? Any Tom, Jake, Sally, Sue, or Harry can find the fruit of happiness or find the sword of brightness. But it takes a real prince or a real princess to find the white bird. What do you think? Any ideas? Take a moment and just reflect on the whole story. We'll come back to this question in a minute. Reflect on the whole story. And pick one part of the story that resonated for you, that made some sense for your life, or for something that's happened. So just take a moment and reflect on that. And we'd like to hear what came up for you, if anything did. Anybody? Just raise your hand, speak up. Pat? Microphone?
I like the part about how when he attained the white bird, he recognized what it really was and decided to not use the white bird as an object, but establish a relationship with it.
Nice. Gary.
The moment for me is when he put that little hat on and transformed into something totally different, you know, yeah. A bird, and was able to transverse this huge distance to a very dangerous place with a very dangerous person and grab her by the hair.
That's great.
And not let go.
That's a huge thing. All those, everybody else did, all the other princes were still, they were stones. So what Gary pointed out there, that the prince turned into something else. He couldn't make it up there as the prince.
I like the ending when the white dove recognizes the prince and goes to him and the sword gets pulled out. Or he's able to pull out the sword. It's like these two passive elements of the story the whole time have a lot of power in the end and affect the outcome in a big way.
And the two passive elements being?
The dove and the sword are referred to, they're passive. Mm-hmm. They don't really take on any kind of role. They're just sort of items.
Mm.
But they kind of transform in the end to becoming something. They change their lives change, I guess. They become different things in the end.
Nice. Christina, is there another mic over here? Yeah.
The fact that even though the intentions were there and they were good, he had to find his way. He had a little greed. Didn't work out. He kept persevering. So there was a journey of having a result, not end up, not giving up, learning from it.
Mm. Yeah. You can think of, if you've ever watched any Jackie Chan movies, the way Jackie Chan just keeps responding to whatever comes at him. Just keeps working with it, keeps working with it.
I liked that he had the Book of Wisdom and he consulted it. And in the beginning he did something just a little different. And then he started doing exactly what it said and had better results. But at the end, he was stripped naked. The book was gone. It wasn't mentioned anymore. And then he just went to the gate and waited. And the sword and the bird came to him.
Huh. Nice.
I think a lot of people are touching on this, but for me, the same thing, that it's what he formed an emotional bond with, the white bird, that then returned to him. And that, for me, just on this retreat, it reminds me of all these instructions that I've followed for a long time about opening to the field of awareness. But this time there was the instruction also to open emotionally to it. And that, I don't know if it's analogous, but that is sort of had a big effect on my, what I got from this retreat.
Very nice. So,
I like that the white bird recognized who the prince was all along, even when she was riding with him no matter what he did. At the end, when his outer appearance had changed, she knew who he was all along. She knew who he was.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Laura.
I was really touched yesterday and felt almost foolish by how deeply I was touched by the journey, that he kept screwing up, but it was important to screw up in order to take the next step.
Yes.
And then the way the story ends, in fact, if he hadn't screwed up a couple of times, he wouldn't have had the white bird. And he wouldn't have been recognized.
That's wonderful, yeah. I mean, it's like receiving the results. Oftentimes we want to ignore the bad results. That's how you find your way, exactly, yeah.
Carolyn, Sonia, Kim's back there.
I love the whole story. I love your delivery. The suspense is not... I hate those to-be-continued things. And they did that with the Superman comics. I quit Superman comics. It's that perseverance, not knowing that you're going to get it. I never got the feeling that he was going to win. Huh. It was just the next challenge or the next... Oh, okay, it says to do this. And there was this... just willingness. I mean, things that would have wiped me out. He was duped by his family. That's a kill. That'll always get you. And big, ugly, scary things. And he just kept moving. I think because the integrity was, he was going to hold his word, his intention was to bring this back. And okay, he got robbed of that, but he still showed up in tatters. And the final blessing was his. So.
Yeah.
So not like life.
What Ken pointed to a few moments ago, that the four steps, showing up, opening to what is, it keeps cycling around and around and around. If you stop, you're stopped. Kim.
The thing that most resonated with me was his initial impulse at the beginning of the story was to go to, enter here and you will pay what you can.
Take what you need and pay what you can.
Take what you need and pay what you can. And he found things inside that were not so nice, and he took care of them.
Mm-hmm.
I like that impulse.
Mm-hmm. What else? Ask about White Bird.
Sure, go ahead.
Yeah.
Actually, you've received two answers already.
Yeah. What is the white bird? Or who is the white bird? Or in your life, what is the white bird? Microphone, please.
That place that knows.
Mm-hmm.
That place that knows.
That which really recognizes you.
Hmm.
That you know it and it knows you.
Hmm. Anyone else? Laura.
But also not what you thought you were looking for. Not what you went off in search of.
Nice, yeah. Didn't know you'd find it. You didn't know you'd find it.
You didn't know you were looking for it.
Exactly, yeah, you set out. Michelle.
Is it also the part of you that serves what's true?
Is it?
Question for you.
Question for you. What's the difference between what knows and that which serves what is true?
It sounds to me like the same thing.
Is it?
But what knows was I'm sorry, the only thing I can think of is a little bit too New Agey for me. Okay. I couldn't quite place it.
Yeah, so what Michelle might be pointing to here is that what knows is not necessarily passive. What knows has some relationship with action.
I think do we call this Buddha nature?
What's Buddha nature?
Original mind, that which knows.
What's original mind?
The white bird.
Good answer.
I think that was the case of cover your losses.
Well done, though.
Very well done, yes.
What about those two brothers that ran off? Yeah? What else? What about those two brothers? What's that like?
Anybody know those two brothers?
Yeah. Alex?
They're the part of you that wants what they want and doesn't want to pay for it. And so you get these spiritual attainments, not that I know what the white bird is meant to represent, and then you try to use them as tools, and it falls apart.
You try to use them as tools to get something, like to wake up or something like that. It's a danger.
How often does the story take place? This is what Jeff means when it takes place in another time. Molly.
Do you use the brothers against the man with the red eyes? The old man?
You want to use the brothers against the man with the red eyes?
Since they're tools.
Why would you want to do that?
Weasel your way to get something, and you're trying to destroy the man with the red eyes, and you would try skillful means.
I'm picturing a wrestling match. I'm not quite sure.
You're working against yourself, basically, but that would be maybe one way to work against yourself. Do you see what I mean? Yeah.
Almost. So to use the two brothers, that one way of grasping at things, of wanting to get something from something.
Even when you're trying to destroy your opponent, even when you're trying to use the sword to destroy the man with the red eyes, you can trick yourself by using these two brothers to do it.
Oh, I see.
Ah, okay.
Nice. Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like
right.
You trick yourself into thinking that you're actually destroying this person, but you're actually stepping out the back, kind of.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. And they just go to work.
Yeah.
That's the problem there.
Yeah, that's nice. Thank you.
Yes, this happens quite frequently. Yes, you try to get clever with this stuff. Okay. One thing I just want to touch on very quickly before we close. It's an important topic. Don't have much time. The ethics of power. As we noted when we did the sword exercise, if you aren't present in the experience, you've already violated the ethics of power. You're a predator. So presence is the ground. Balance is the optimum condition for the arising of presence. so that it is the only thing worth defending, worth wielding power for. This gives rise to obligation. There are many facets to obligation. This gives rise to boundary. A boundary is defined by balance. Where things are out of balance, a boundary has been violated. The exercise of power is used to address that imbalance. And that's what engages obligation. Obligation is dependent on your environment. It's dependent on the relationships you have. One way this is viewed is in terms of order, others first, environment second, you third. But you're always part of the situation. There's more on obligation, but we don't have time to go into it. Some of you are familiar with this in terms of the three bases of relationship. I think there's something up on the website about that. Some article somewhere. Mutual benefit, shared aim, and emotional connection. And then the last element is courage. Courage is what you experience when you accept your obligation and stand at the boundary. As Ta Kwan notes in Unfettered Mind, the book, this was very badly misconstrued in samurai culture, who felt that they had to duel someone who insulted them, that was the obligation in defending the boundary. And as he points out, that's nonsense. That's just a refined expression of your anger. The only boundary worth defending is balance, because that's what creates the conditions for presence. Now, that's a somewhat pithy summary. With respect to courage, courage isn't about not feeling fear. It's about experiencing fear and being able to act anyway. So it requires a higher level of attention. One very important aspect of power, which I've alluded to before. It's different from the other gestures. With ecstasy, which shows up in spiritual practice as devotion, if you screw up, you may go a bit crazy. People will say, he was touched by God. With insight, if you screw up, you'll end up exploiting or being exploited. With compassion, if you screw up, you'll end up a bit like a tyrant. You'll end up as a tyrant. And power, if you screw up, people die. So it's serious. People die. So keep this in mind. I think that's everything. Do you have any words you'd like to add?
It's time for dinner.
Yes.
Can you come back here at some point tomorrow?
Yes. Yeah. We have meditation this evening. We'll complete the interviews. Tomorrow morning we have meditation in the early morning as usual.
Retains all rights to these podcasts. If you do wish to use a part or a whole podcast, please send an email to podcasts@unfetteredmind.org.